very quickly and leave plenty of time for questions. I'm a sociologist. That's crucial that you should know that. The talk has three parts. Part one, which has a lot of slides, is an introduction to work that we've been doing recently in Cardiff University. Slides 4 to 26, I'm going to introduce something called the periodic table of expertises. It's meant to make you slightly irritated, the fact that I've called it a periodic table. Part two will be a new analysis of tacit knowledge, which is something that's currently in the form of a book manuscript. And part three will be this last thing: what difference does the internet make to any of what I've said? These three parts are slightly different, but they all bear on the final part. So this is part one. The origins of this program of research that we've been doing for the last 6 or 7 or 8 years is worries about how there's a tendency in there's a tendency in my field to, in the light of postmodernism, to try and pass more and more technological decision-making rights to the general public. It's a tendency that I distrust, and so one of the reasons we started this was to try and stop people doing that. The second thing that started it was my puzzlement about what I was doing as a sociologist, doing fieldwork in the area of gravitational wave physics for decades. I found myself sitting around talking physics to physicists over coffee and over lunch and actually saying some reasonable things. And I started to puzzle, what does this mean that I as a sociologist am talking physics? The start of this program, the first shot fired in anger, as it were, is a notorious paper that was published in 2002 in the journal Social Studies of Science, in which I published a paper generally about every year throughout my career up to then. I have not published one subsequently. That will tell you the story. This was very badly received by my community. But on the upside, for all the bibliometric analysts here, it's been by far and away the most cited paper that Social Studies of Science has ever published. So, you know, that's a compensation. And more recently, we wrote a book. As you probably know, sociologists of science like myself have been deconstructing science, as it were, for many decades. The paper said it's time to stop this, not to go back on what has been done, but to ask a different kind of question. And the question is, what is a policymaker supposed to do with this stuff we've been doing? And the paper argued what we've been doing doesn't tell a policymaker what to do next. And we've got to try and think of a way of using what we know about science to tell policymakers what to do. And the answer is start to analyze the nature of expertise rather than the nature of truth. And it got us into a lot of trouble. Some of the program is written up in this book, Rethinking Expertise, which was published by University of Chicago Press in 2007. And central to that book is this thing called the Periodic Table of Expertises. Now, you can imagine how much a title like the periodic table irritated my colleagues in social studies of science. I mean, just think how much it's irritating you right now. Okay, it irritated them much, much more. So here I am starting to say, well, we're doing science. We're classifying stuff. We're giving you a periodic table, something that's universal and lasting. Whereas the whole 2 decades of social studies of science, in which I've been deeply involved, in fact, one of the pioneers, has been dissolving things and showing how fuzzy edged all boundaries are and how you could never say anything for certain, and so on and so forth. But the periodic table of expertises looks like this. The top row is ubiquitous expertises, and those are the expertises you have to have just to live in society. Natural language speaking, knowing how close to walk to somebody when you're walking along the pavement. All the things that sociologists and anthropologists study, okay? Everybody has a lot of expertise. Nobody really noticed that we had these expertises until people started to try and make artificial intelligences, when they then discovered that actually natural language speaking was an incredibly difficult expertise and very hard to formalise and so forth. So that's the ubiquitous expertises table. Now, ignore the second line and go to the third line, specialist expertises. The second line is just a footnote. Specialist expertises is where it gets more, you see how it works. The T two left-hand, the three left-hand ones, if you can call them expertises, are things that you can find out about a specialist area just by using your ubiquitous expertises or your ubiquitous tacit knowledge. So you can go and read stuff. So beer mat knowledge is, I found out how a hologram works by reading the back of a beer mat made by the Baby Sham company. It says light is split to go all round the object, and then you capture it all and you get a three-dimensional image. That's on the back of a beer mat, a coaster. Now I know how a hologram works, okay? So that's beer mat knowledge. Popular understanding is what you get from popular science books, which are thicker and, you know, like that. And primary source knowledge is what you can get if you're determined enough and you actually go and pick up the professional journals in the library somewhere, or download them, or get them off the archive or whatever, and start reading those. And as a non-specialist, you might be determined enough to get that far. But in our, according to our account, you haven't got really real expertise until when you start tacit knowledge. As you see, the whole table is driven by the idea of tacit knowledge, right? Things you know but can't. And the only way to get specialist tacit knowledge is to mix socially with experts. Ubiquitous expertise of experts, like I did when I started doing my field study of gravitational wave physics. I started to spend lots of time with gravitational wave physicists, and according to me, I started to gain some specialist tacit knowledge. Now, the new thing about this is that well, I'll just go around down the rest of the table first. The next line of the table is about meta-expertises, which is expertises that you use to judge between experts. Okay, so it's not judging, not being an expert, but judging between experts. So you've got these ones here. This one here is a sort of expertise that you use to judge between politicians. You know, you use this kind of general expertise to know that George Bush is really stupid. And this one is where you may have some local information about some particular person or other. That's local discrimination. Over here, these are external ones, so you don't need any expertise to use them. Here you need a bit of expertise. Technical connoisseurship. Connoisseurship is expertise in consumption. So a wine connoisseur can't make wine, but they know how to consume wine. Yeah, and they know what's good wine and what isn't good wine. And technical connoisseurship is, well, I don't know, let's say the expertise of the architect who tells me whether the tiling in my bathroom has been done properly, even though the architect may not be able to do any tiling him or herself, okay? Downward discrimination is the normal, I'm not going to talk about it because it'll take too long to go into it, but it's just the normal sort of thing you use when you say that person's wrong in virtue of the fact that they're being completely stupid. And referred expertise is something that I'll talk about in a moment, in a slide. And then the final line of the table is meta-criteria. This is if you can't be bothered to use all of this, you try and use something else, like somebody's credentials. And that doesn't really work at all. You can't tell whether anybody's any good by looking at their credentials. There's a philosopher called Alvin Goldman who thinks you can tell whether anybody's any good by looking at their track record of success in making judgments. And we kind of disinclined to believe that, because when you really want expertise, it's often for new things that people don't have a track record about. And then this third one, which we like best, is we say, well, the best thing you can do is look at people's experience in an area. People with a lot of experience are like to be good judges. Lee.
Misleading, because we talk lots about track records in hiring and
The data goes like this, that there are certain sorts of people I'm going to talk of as experts who are experience-based experts. The classic case in the social sciences is written up by a man called Brian Wynne, who also caused all the trouble, incidentally, but the first thing he did was quite good, which was to show that when radioactive fallout fell from the Chernobyl explosion onto the Cumbrian Fells, the Ministry of Agriculture and Fisheries scientists went up there and started telling the sheep farmers what to do in order to minimise the effect on their flocks. And the sheep farmers said, no, that's not going to work. And the sheep farmers were experts in the ecology of sheep, and what they said should have been taken into the calculation but wasn't, because they had no credentials. So you can have experts with no credentials. And of course you can have people with lots of credentials with no expertise. So it's for that reason. Now if you're talking about hiring people in a very, very specialist institution like this, well, of course, then credentials are going to be a little bit more reliable. But you know, really, you ask for a lot more of the credentials than you hire people, don't you? Even you don't really trust them.
I was asking more about track record, but I'll come back.
All right, sure. Now, on this talk, the first part of this talk, I'm going to concentrate on this little thing here. This is the brand new idea here, interactional expertise. Contributory expertise is what you normally think of as a specialist expertise. It's the ability to do things. So in gravitational wave physics, it's the ability to build bits of the gravitational wave detector, calculate the waveform of an inspiring binary neutron star, polish mirrors, design mirror suspension, or whatever, something like that. Yeah. But interactional expertise is what I claim I got from spending 20 years hanging around having coffee with gravitational wave physicists. The ability to talk about gravitational wave physics pretty well, to sometimes make some sensible judgments, to even on one remarkable, and I have to say totally untypical occasion, have somebody who just built a new design of interferometer said, I wish you'd said that 2 years ago, it wouldn't have wasted all that time. But that's untypical, but very rare for me to say anything that anybody takes any notice of. But they usually say, no, you've got that wrong, and then they give me very good reasons for why they've got it wrong, because they've thought it all through before, you know, that sort of thing. And so I think I can, you know, I can talk gravitational wave physics, and it's this notion of interactional expertise that I'm going to talk about now for a little while, because I think it's quite an important idea. Incidentally, I should have said that the time I've spent, I wrote this 870-page book about gravitational wave physics. It was published in 2004. So that's an indication of how much time I've spent with these guys. It's not a trivial thing to acquire interactional expertise. It's not just learning to talk the talk, as I like to say. It's learning to walk the talk. You know, it's quite hard to acquire. I'm still very much deeply involved in this case study with the gravitational wave physicists, by the way. The question about, the hypothesis is that you can learn a domain language without learning the domain abilities. You can learn to do the talk without being able to do the doing. That's the claim. And at one point, I actually exposed myself to a test of this. We have developed this methodology called the imitation game. We've written some software on which it runs now. Anybody can run it. If they write to me, you can use our software on the Cardiff University server. You have a judge with contributory expert. We always have our judges with contributory expertise. We have a person with interactional and contributory expertise, e.g. a gravitational wave physicist, e.g. the judge would be a gravitational wave physicist, and then me, who has interactional expertise, so I claim, and I'm pretending to be a full-blown expert. Yeah? And then the judge asks questions of these two guys. Judge knows that one of these people is me, and knows that the other person is a genuine gravitational wave physicist. He asks questions, and I have to see and then we have to see if he can tell the difference, like the Turing test. Okay, imitation game was the forerunner of the Turing test. They played it with men and women.
Is it important that he does
not have interactional expertise? No. By default, anybody that has contributory expertise also has interactional expertise.
Okay.
It's a good question, and that's what the second line of the table is about, but I don't want to go into that. Just assume that anybody with contributory expertise, just assume there's a transitive relationship. You can have a contributory expertise and have an interaction expertise. So here's some examples of the questions that are asked. We'll concentrate on question 5, which is the most revealing one. And you can guess who's the gravitational wave physicist and who's me. Questions at the top. And those are the two answers. One is a gravitational wave physicist answering it, and one of them is me.
You're the one on the left.
I'm the one on the left. Okay, who thinks I'm the one on the left? Who thinks I'm the one on the right? Want any more time, or? Are we all done? One going once, going twice.
You're the one in the middle.
Gone. Right, one more vote. Who thinks I'm the one on the left? Who thinks I'm the one on the right? Okay, the people who think I'm on the left have it. In fact, I'm the one on the right. Okay? And in fact, the result was slightly embarrassing, in fact, because the physicist, what we did is we took the whole dialogue and we sent it out to other gravitational wave physicists and said, guess who's who? And most people took me to be the physicist. Okay, and this question 5 was quite an important question in their decision. And the reason was as follows, that the answer on the left can be found in a paper that's published in the field, which everybody knows. But I didn't know that paper. So I had to make up an answer right there and then in about 5 minutes. And I got it right, just by thinking about the geometry of the way a gravitational wave was going to interact with an interferometer. And they thought, hey, this guy must know his stuff because he's actually thought out the right answer. Whereas the other one, he could have just got paper. So, you know, it shouldn't have come out that I was chosen to be the physicist, but for what we wanted at best is a chance result. But anyway, it was sort of better than a chance in a strange kind of way.
So which one is yours?
I'm that.
Yeah, that's what I picked instantly.
This one?
Yeah. You saw,
I thought you said I was this one, didn't you?
No, he was the only one. I was the only one who said you were on the right.
No, there were one or two people on there.
I think they said left, and I did it just based on the language. It was completely obvious to me.
Oh, well, both questions have been rewritten. So.
I see. The
content has been kept the same, but the language is supposed to be roughly uniform. So, but I'll tell you this. If it's any consolation, we've tried this on all kinds of people, and actually, for some reason or other, lay people tend to get it right. Physicists tend to get it wrong. Okay, physicists or gravitational wave physicists tend to go for the content. Yeah, whereas lay people tend to look for stylistic cues, and there are seemingly stylistic cues that suggest this is the non-physicist. So yeah.
I look to see what, you know, the right hand side looks like somebody who's trying less hard. And the person on the left, yeah.
Well, I can show, we always ask the people why they thought this. And the gravitational wave physicists said, because that answer looks as though it's been thought out, whereas the other answer looks as though it's just repeating some standards. Okay. But the crucial thing is right. You know, if you want to know what it feels like to do this, let me tell you, it's very, very nerve-wracking indeed. And when I saw that my answer was different to my colleague's answer, I thought, oh, shit, this is a waste of time, isn't it? And I rang him up and said, hey, Joe, I said this. And there was a pause and said, hey, yeah, actually, that's not bad. Yes, Lee.
I say this with a little more body. Do you have any comment on this in the light of Alan Sokol's prank?
Yeah.
You have lots of examples of these in your book.
We've done this kind of experiment. I think this Alan Sokol, this is Nature, who were kind enough to write up this experiment. Okay, it's a news article. Sociologist fools physics judges, and at the end of it, they get a quotation from Alan Sokol. And Nature wrote it up as though this is so-called, if it were. Actually, it isn't. Because my claim here is that I'm demonstrating genuine expertise. I'm not hoaxing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Alan Sokol was hoaxing. The whole point about a hoax is it isn't any good if you've got genuine expertise. That actually, this has nothing to do with Alan Sokol. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the other feature between this kind of test and a hoax is that in the case of hoaxes, they generally only work if nobody knows they're being fooled. Here, all the judges knew they were being fooled, and that one of the people answering was me, not just any old person, but me. Now, if everybody said, here's a load of submissions to social text, one of them is a hoax, one would probably have got the Alan Sokol right. You know, I don't know for sure, because social text is not terribly well edited, and it is a very funny article, well done, but that's my presumption. Okay. Alan Sokol talks some complete nonsense here, by the way, if you want to pick up Nature. And if you want to know what's complete nonsense, I'll tell you if you read it up here.
Thinking about the randomness factor here, how does that enter into
randomness? Yeah, well, let me go on a little bit. Okay.
Do you have any training?
Yeah, I did physics when I was in what you would call high school.
And since then, have you read a lot of physics?
Well, I've spent all this time as a gravitational wave physicist, so you could call that training.
And you have the same reasoning capability, although you have a different approach to your training.
Well, they're cleverer than me. Okay. On the whole. Not all of them.
Which, I'll leave it.
The question, if you're leading up to, the question you might be asking, and this is the most difficult question I always have to answer, is you're not, you have actually become a physicist, so what are you telling us? That's the real tricky one. And I can only answer this. I'm never going to be a co-author on a physics paper. They will not let me loose with the soldering iron on the $250 million interferometers. There's nothing I can do, and I can't do any of the maths, okay? Not a single one of the equations can I deal with, all right? So, and now I don't think that's damning for the last thing, for other reasons, which I'm going to, if we have time, but I don't think we're going to have time. We did this experiment in a variety of different formats, and I'll just draw your attention to this one, where we had the gravitational wave physicist as the judge, a gravitational wave physicist as the control, and some astrophysicists and astronomers who work in the same department as gravitational wave physicists as taking my role. They were completely hopeless. Okay. And in fact, we even did it under this circumstance where I took the role of the judge. Okay. Here's gravitational wave physicists, here's astrophysicists and astronomers, and they were still completely hopeless. I could immediately spot who was good. Okay?
So how could you spot them? What was the...
I asked them technical questions, they couldn't answer them.
Right.
And I could answer them. So this interaction expertise is quite a powerful thing. One of the conclusions you have to draw from this format of the experiment is you want to be, and one of the reasons why the periodic table of expertise changes things is you can't trust scientists talking outside their specialism. They're not great at making judgments as soon as they move a little way outside their specialism. Okay, these are astrophysicists and astronomers working in the same department as gravitational wave physicists, and they couldn't do the stuff that I could do. Yeah. Now, we've done a lot, to answer this goes back to some of the earlier questions, we've done a lot of these interactional expertise imitation game experiments. I'll just tell you the results of the latest one we did. They're not all about science. The results of the latest one we did was we asked blind people, in fact, we wanted congenitally blind people, we couldn't find any. These are people who'd gone blind in early childhood, had sticks and guide dogs and so on, and we wanted them to pretend to be sighted. The theory being that because they're immersed in sighted society, they would have gained the ability to discourse like a sighted person. Yeah. So we said, you pretend to be sighted people. And the control experiment, where we ask sighted people to pretend to be blind people. Okay. And the theory says, here the judge is going to have no better than a chance. And here the judge is going to be able to identify. The judges here would be blind people. You see, the judge always has to have the contributory expertise.
Well, what were they doing?
What? They're asking them questions over the internet. Okay. So here's the kind of questions that... This is who's sighted test. This is the sort of question. This is me actually. I was here being the judge, trying to work out who was sighted and who was blind, and that's the question. I thought I'll ask a real stinking question, and that's my question, and those are the two answers. And you can try and make your guess as to who's sighted and who's not. Have you made your guess? That's the blind person. And here's the other way round, where it's the sighted people pretending to be blind. Okay, it's a couple of questions. Nice. Okay, well. I don't even remember who's who, but I think the crucial thing is you probably can't tell. But the blind people can tell. Immediately. And instantly. Okay? Here's the result of these experiments. On the right you have the chance condition, which is blind people pretending to be sighted. 18 correct guesses, 11 wrong guesses, and 27 couldn't guess with a high level. Right. The blind people identifying blind, sighted people pretending to be blind. Incidentally, these people only ever ask three questions. And chi-squared test is 0.0025. off the scale of social science. So that experiment kind of works.
Can you go back? Go back one?
Well, I can't remember. Hang on, let me see if I can remember from reading.
It must be cited.
No, I don't remember. I can't tell. Yeah. I mean, if you really want to know, you can write to me and I'll send you
Okay. I would guess definitely they must have hired a dog first.
Done. Anyway, so that's what we've been dealing with. I'll just tell you a little bit more about this. This is another bit of the periodic table of expertise on which we have done some work. We've done most work on this, you see. This is a whole program of research. Yeah. So as you see, this is the kind of work we've done on this box here. Now we've done some work on this box here. This is written up in a paper. The other thing you want, I said about the book called Rethinking Expertise, which was published by University of Chicago Press in 2007. There's a set of special issue of a journal with a lot of case studies of this, which is a journal called Studies in History and Philosophy of Science. And the December 2007 one has a lot of papers in, and I'm going to refer to three of them today. And there's a fourth one in there, which you might be interested in, Paul, is about how physicists read papers. And how the fact that they don't read the mathematics in them step by step when they read them in a normal way. It's another story. Anyway, this paper is called They Give You the Keys and Say Drive It, Managers Referred Expertise and Other Expertise. And the authors, as you see, are me and Gary Sanders. Gary Sanders is the director of the $1 billion 30-meter telescope, okay, who I know because he used to be the project director of LIGO. And so after he'd been in this directing 30-meter telescope for about a year, I went and interviewed him. And incidentally, Gary Sanders knew what I was talking about when I was talking about referred expertise and things like this, because I'd developed the concept whilst he was still there in LIGO, and I gave a presentation in Caltech about these notions, and he was sitting in the front row nodding, as I remember. Mm-hmm. You know, it's another one of these nervous moments. Okay. So here's Gary Sanders. The phrase in the title, they give you the keys and say drive it, is what Gary said to me. You know, I come into this thing, this $1 billion, and they give me the keys and say drive it. What am I doing here? You know, sorry.
The reason Paul. Gary Sanders understands this is before LIGO, he was a high energy
experimentalist.
So
he's done it once
before.
The same
conversion as you, yeah, the gravitational people.
Precisely. And so it was, in fact, it wasn't the part of the way the notion of interaction and expertise came up. Was suddenly realizing, hey, Gary and Barry Barish actually don't know that much more about interferometry than I do. Of course, they do know more about it, but in a manner of speaking, they've gained the same kind of expertise because they're high energy physicists by training. So this is Gary talking about the problems with adaptive optics. Can you all read it, or shall I read it out? All right, we've got to go a little bit faster, I think. Anyway, the point is that Gary is here making decisions about which kind of adaptive optics they're going to use, as he says to me. I have to make these decisions. I make the decisions. I see the guys looking back at me and nodding and say, yeah, he does. He's got a handle on this. Even though he's never done any adaptive optics in his life, he can't do the equations, but in the time he's been there, he's mastered the interaction expertise to the point where the people have started to respect it, okay, and will accept his decisions. This is what it looks like. Sorry, this is just my template diagram something. These are all the little specialisms in, say, gravitational waves, mirror polishing, suspension design, calculating, inspiring binary star wave fronts. Everybody's talking away to each other. This is the power of the idea of interactional expertise. You haven't got a field unless that person can cooperate with that person. But that person cannot do that person's work, and that person cannot do that person's work. So he doesn't have his contributory expertise, and she doesn't have her contributory expertise. But what makes it work is the interactional expertise, which is flying through the whole thing. in my grander moments, I say this explains the whole division of labour, which you can't understand otherwise. And there's me grinning away because I've got the interaction expertise as well. Ha, ha, ha. And then you see, you come in, there's another field of physics, high energy physics, shall we say. And there's Gary Sanders sitting with his feet, having contributory expertise in some area of high energy physics. And then he moves sideways, okay? And he learns the interactional expertise of this other field, which is what enables him to manage it. But he actually has more than me, because he's got his feet in there, and because he's done managing before, he's got what we call referred expertise. I mean, some of this is just simply clunky, that you know, he can solve differential equations, and if they need solving here, they need solving there as well. That's easy. But there's other much more subtle stuff. Like, he knows how to assess what to do when two people come up to him and say, they both say, mine's the only way to do this, you fool. Because he's heard all this before, and he knows how you have to discount that. And that kind of expertise can be referred from one science management field to another. Okay. Now, you can see that some of this refers on the discussion yesterday about interdisciplinary collaboration. And there is a paper about that, same special issue. It's called Trading Zones and Interaction Expertise. The term trading zone was invented by a historian of science called Peter Gallison and is about the zone between two separate language groups. The stuff you were talking about yesterday afternoon has been talked about and talked about and talked about endlessly by philosophers, historians, many, many case studies of it, and we've made our own little contribution too. Okay. The idea of how people from different language communities talk to each other is a classic problem in this area. And slightly frustrating yesterday, the conversation, because we kept on saying, no, you fools, look, we've done all this, we've thought about it all, and so on and so forth. We have, and some of these thoughts, again, can be found in that special issue. Oops, go back in. And under the paper with that title. Yeah, did you have a question?
As you've spoken, what's come to my mind is whether or not we're really talking about...
I'll tell you what, can we leave it to the question session?
Who are focused and people who, in fact, are more broad-minded.
Let me get back to it at the end, okay? I'll try, because there's a lot to go through. I've got to sort of zip through. Oh, I'm going to have to zip through it very fast now. Just briefly, gravitational waves were invented by Joe Weber in the 1960s. Sorry, gravitational wave detection science. It was invented by Joe Weber in the 1960s. There he is with one of his resonant bars. The experiment cost about $100,000. He said he'd seen gravitational waves in the early 70s, okay, published various papers on it. By 1975, these claims were pretty well universally rejected. But I love Joe Weber. He actually founded a new field, because without him, we wouldn't have a $250 million gravitational wave interferometer field. But Weber, who died in the year 2000, never accepted that he was wrong. Okay, that's Joe Weber working on his resonant bar.
The picture of the Smithsonian with a sign on it, yeah. Saying,
"That's right,
detected gravitational waves."
Yeah, yeah. And this is the modern technology. These are the two big interferometers in America with 4 kilometer arms, and this is the $250 million stuff. One in Hanford Nuclear Reservation, and one in Washington State. Anyway, here's the point. You see the difference between this side of the table and this side of the table. Here, people have specialist tacit knowledge which they get by mixing in the scientific community. Here they don't. I'm going to try and deliver this difference to you. First of all, remember my answer to question 5. This depended on me gaining understanding from mixing with these guys. This answer had not been written down anywhere, as far as I know, as far as anybody's able to tell me, until I said it and wrote it down. As far as I know, I'm the first person to have written this down. Well, now you can transfer this over here, because it's in the public domain, you can find it on the internet. Okay? But at the time I was doing it, it wasn't anywhere on the internet. The time I was saying it, I was inventing it de novo. Joe Weber in 1996 published a paper. He was able to publish that paper because he belongs over here. 1996. Here is the paper. It's entitled Search for Correlations of Gamma Ray Bursts with Gravitational Radiation Antenna. Joe Weber said he found correlation between his old gravity waves and gamma ray bursts. I don't have to explain to all of you what gamma ray bursts are. There's the abstract of the paper, okay, and there's the crucial line. Probability of the correlations of accidentals estimated approximately 6 to the 10 to the minus 5, a Nobel Prize winning finding, as I'm sure you would agree. Joe Weber's old gravity wave turned out to be correlated with gamma ray bursts with that level of probability of being reached. So I was kind of interested in this, needless to say. And I went around to my colleagues in the gravitational wave field and I said, what do you make of that paper by Joe Weber? Okay? And what I discovered is that only three people in the world read it. Joe Weber, the referee, and me. Okay, because by this time, Joe Weber had become so discredited that nobody was even going to bother to read a paper that said he found a correlation between gravitational waves and gamma ray bursts. You see the difference between being inside and being outside. If you're an extraterrestrial and you come down to Earth and want to find about earthly science by reading the journals, you're going to think Joe Weber has discovered a correlation between gravitational waves and gamma ray bursts, because there it is in a scientific journal. But if you're in there, you know that he hasn't, in spite of the existence of that paper. So here's the difference. You've got to think about the difference in what I call the core set of scientists, and maybe a few just around them, the politicians who read things, and the public. And the way they use scientific information are very different. It's no problem for the insiders that Joe Weber had written this paper, because there are mechanisms of social control. Everybody knows, he just ignored it. It doesn't matter. Okay? Fine, he's published a paper. Who cares? It's his problem. Yeah? And now the most shocking part of this whole talk. I put it in a font called Chiller. So all this stuff you're talking about, you know, you've got to have another thing. Let me tell you another little story about Joe Weber. Earlier, 10 years earlier than this thing, in fact, 15 years earlier than this thing, Joe Weber had written a paper in which he published it in a respectable physics journal, in which he proved that the cross-section of his bars to gravitational waves was 10 to the 9th greater than everybody had thought. And therefore, you didn't have to spend $250 million on LIGO. You could spend $100,000 or $200,000 on building a few more of his bars. This was at a time when LIGO, people were thinking about whether to fund LIGO or not. He sent this claim to Barbara Mikulski, his congresswoman. People got wind of this, and they got scared out of their lives. People wrote papers proving that Joe Weber was wrong and published them in physics journals for only one reason, so that Barbara Mikulski could say this thing has been defeated and it says so in the physics journals. Okay? Because nobody else was taking the slightest bit of notice. It's just Joe Weber again. Yeah. So when you start to think about what physics papers do, you have to think sociologically about their functions. They're not just information transmitters, they're certifiers and all kinds of other things. In this case, that paper could have had a very powerful political influence. And the physicist acted to stop it having a powerful influence by publishing other papers. Otherwise, they were informationally irrelevant. As I said before, I would mention Jack Sarfati, who had a lot of trouble with archive. Okay. Yeah, they had a lot of trouble with archive because archive is archive. Jack Sarfati, I'm sure, doesn't really cause anybody serious trouble within physics because of the oral culture. Well, whatever he's had problems with. Same sort of point I'm making, okay? And when you start to look at published information going out to the public, in Britain we're having a measles epidemic because parents stopped injecting their children with mumps, measles and rubella vaccine because somebody said something at a press conference and then it got out into the open. But there was no evidence whatsoever for the link between mumps, measles and rubella and autism as it was claimed. Same sort of thing happened in South Africa with Thabo Mbeki, who licensed his refusal to administer antiretroviral drugs to pregnant mothers in virtue of the fact that there was a dispute about the safety of these drugs on the internet. But if you'd been an insider, you'd have known that this was completely and utterly discredited. But you couldn't tell it And here's Tarburn, Becky, advising the honourable members of the National Council to access the huge volume of literature on this matter available on the internet so that all of us can approach the issue from the same base of information. Telling his colleagues, go to the internet and you can read these scientific papers and then you'll know that AZT isn't safe. Okay? But in fact, in the oral culture, there is no problem with AZT whatsoever. And it seems quite likely that tens of thousands of South African babies acquired AZT as a result. Can we wait till a question session? Because I'm surely trying to zip through, which I'm not going to do. New analysis of tacit knowledge. This is the new book. There are three kinds of tacit knowledge: contingent tacit knowledge, somatic tacit knowledge, and collective tacit knowledge. Contingent tacit knowledge, here's the example. Here's an example. That's a thing called a T-laser. The photograph was taken in the 60s, hence the lady. Okay. The T-laser is actually in there. That's the crucial bit you need to look at, just in there. Okay. Who learned to make one? This is my case study. I discovered that the only people who could learn to make a T-laser were people who had personal contact with another successful laser builder who'd already made one. Those who used the literature alone, the journals, and there were very good journal articles about how to build one, including Review of Scientific Instruments, that are all the manufacturer's part numbers. Those who used the literature alone failed even though they'd built something that followed the circuit diagram. To make the laser work, and you could test whether the laser was working or not, because when you fired it up, it made concrete smoke, one of the team had to spend time with people who could already do it. Why was this? Well, there were several reasons, but here's one of them. If we concentrate on that little bit of the laser, you can see some wires going down to the top electrode. Okay, those wires there. Here's the circuit diagram of the T-laser. The wires you've just seen a picture of is that wire there, which goes from a big, great big capacitor. Yeah. And this capacitor, when you actually build it in those days, was a great big heavy thing, like the size of a car battery. Okay. So if you built one of these things from the circuit diagram, you would naturally enough place the capacitor on the bench, and that would be the wire that we've been referring to, roughly like that. Okay. And if you did that, your laser wouldn't work. Okay. To make your laser work, you actually had to build a framework and put your capacitor above the top electrode in a big heavy framework with a wire like that. Why? Because the wire had to be short because of its inductance. But nobody knew that. Okay. They didn't find that out till a lot later. Yeah. The thing is, you could make a laser and make it work if you went and spent time with other laser builders, because you'd naturally put the capacitor in the same place as they did, and then it would work. But if you built it from the circuit diagram, you'd put the capacitor down on the deck and it wouldn't work. You wouldn't know why. Okay. Later, people learned it. Learned the importance of the inductance calculations in building one of these lasers. Contingent tacit knowledge I'm talking about. That example was one, an example of uncognized knowledge. Well, of course, science gets done and bits of uncognized knowledge leave the realm of the tacit, which is this gray area. But of course, more stuff's being invented, so more tacit knowledge comes on the end. Another reason for contingent tacit knowledge is people keep secrets. You can often find out people's secrets by visiting their lab. Then you can see things that they wouldn't tell you. Well, maybe people keep less secrets, but then that's just another lump of secrets have gone, but another lump of other people are keeping more secrets. Another reason for contingent tacit knowledge is what's called mismatched saliences. You don't know what to tell anybody else, okay? You don't know what to tell anybody else because the content of your head isn't the content of their head. You don't know what's in their head and you don't know what they need to be told. Well, as people get to know each other better, the problem of mismatched saliences dissolves, but as science moves on, new problems of mismatched saliences come along. So you're always going to have contingent tacit knowledge for social and logistic reasons. Social reasons, because people are always going to keep secrets and tell lies, and logistic reasons, because there's just too much out there to make it all explicit, and anyway, the body of it moves along. The whole expert systems boom, if you remember, it was an attempt to make the whole grey area white, but of course it was completely hopeless. And so is any attempt to make all of this contingent tacit knowledge explicit. But of course, contingent tacit knowledge is the easy case. Somatic tacit knowledge is harder. That's somebody riding a bike. I'm not quite sure who it is, actually. Is anybody? Oh, yeah. And bike riding is the classic case of tacit knowledge, defined by Michael Polanyi. If I know how to ride a bicycle, that does not mean that I can tell how I managed to keep my balance on a bicycle. I may not have the slightest idea of how to do this, or even an entirely wrong or grossly imperfect idea of it, and yet I go on cycling merrily. The funny thing was, though, that Michael Polanyi also gave this formula for riding a bicycle about 2 pages later in his book. Okay, and nobody seems to have noticed that. Yeah. So the question is, why did he call it tacit knowledge? Well, it only makes sense to call it tacit knowledge if you're saying, if you're referring to the human body, the human organism. The human organism cannot use this formula because our brains are too slow. My suggestion is that if we were riding bikes on the moon or some asteroid with very low gravitational field, we could carry the instructions in our hands and consult them like the way we consult the instructions for putting together flat pack furniture, and actually do the calculations and ride a bike calculatively. But to us, it's tacit knowledge because of the way our bodies and brains are made. So this is what I call somatic tacit knowledge. And this activity that Einstein is doing here is bike balancing. There's another feature of bike riding which is completely different, and that's riding in traffic. Now, to ride in traffic, there's no formula for it. It varies from country to country, for example. If anybody's ever been to China, you'll know that it's almost impossible to understand what the hell's going on there on the roads. Okay? That is collective tacit knowledge. It is the tacit knowledge which is located in society, and as far as we know, you can only get by immersing yourself in society. Okay? I haven't got time to do this. This is the final part of the talk. What difference has the internet made? The internet, well, it's just, first of all, don't think about the internet. Think of all kinds of communication: books, letters, papers, telephone, email, internet, computer information, storage and transfer, video conferencing, virtual reality, a brain in the vat, an artificial society, the matrix, and so on. You know, you've got to think about the bandwidth because there's different answers to all of it. So, you know, when you get to a completely artificial society, I don't know what to say. But let's go back to my second line of my periodic table. Remember that crucial dividing line. Over on the right, you're getting tacit knowledge, and it's these three types: contingent, somatic, and collective. Can the internet make any difference? Well, yeah. If our world is heavily saturated with electronic communications, it might alleviate some of the contingent tacit knowledge problem. Okay. You may not have to travel up to get some bit of information, you can get it. But it's never going to eliminate all of it, as you can see from the way tacit knowledge works. Can we eliminate somatic tacit knowledge with machinery? Well, to some extent, yeah. Virtual reality simulators, you can learn to fly an aeroplane, perhaps, in a simulator, or learn a good bit of flying an aeroplane. You could probably learn to ride a bike by riding a bike simulator, though can't imagine you make a lot of money out of it because the bike would be cheaper. And collective tacit knowledge, well, maybe you'll master it by getting brains in vats or constructing the matrix. But to all intents and purposes, that's not here. And the only way we know how to get collective tacit knowledge is by immersing yourself in society. And in the case of specialist tacit knowledge, it's by mixing with the relative community, with the community of scientists. The problem is we don't notice this because we're also heavily pre-socialized by the normal means of socialization. That, of course, the internet and all the rest of it is really useful. Yeah? But it's only useful because we've already got all the socialization to make use of it, and it's just adding bits of information. Remember, if you confuse the two things, then you've got the problem of Barbara Mikulski, Jack Sarfati, and Tarbo and Becky. Thank you.